Hello and welcome to another episode of The Cocktail Conceit. This is a podcast where two bartenders who live in different states but are still best friends come up with an excuse to talk to each other and to drink. That excuse is one of us shares a piece of media that they enjoy, and the other person is going to see it for the first time. And then we talk about it, and at the end, we have to come up with a cocktail based on that piece of media.
Because that's the conceit.
Yeah, that's the conceit. That's the cocktail conceit. My name is Adam. I'm a craft cocktail bartender in Columbus, Ohio, or at least I would be if there wasn't a plague.
Yeah, goddamn plague. And my name is Logan Redden. I'm a bartender and events coordinator in Evansville, Indiana. Or I would be if there wasn't a plague. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I am still bartending a lot at home, just only for myself and my cat. So, you know.
I can't imagine your cat drinks too much.
No, I'm pretty sure it would actually kill him, so I'm not going to do that.
Probably. All right, hey Logan, how are you?
Or at least if you try to keep up with me. I'm doing pretty okay. Hanging in there. Honestly, just like sitting at home and twiddling my thumbs a lot. It's kind of getting a little old. But hey, realistically, it's going to be at least another month. Well, hopefully it'll be at least another month, and then we'll see where we're at after that.
It might be longer than that.
Probably. Just kind of hoping that that curve doesn't spike back up. That would really fucking suck.
Oh, it's gone.
Yeah, probably. I was reading an article. Was talking about reported deaths, like what the CDC is, what is being directly claimed as coronavirus deaths. It's probably not actually accurate, because they're basically comparing graphs of the average death rate, or like what the death rate was last year in areas, and then comparing them to the current death rate. And the spike is a lot higher, and they compared that to reported coronavirus deaths.
Oh, really?
And there's like a, yeah, like New York has like a 3,000 person gap between those two things. And several other cities have at least a couple hundred. So it's likely that there's a lot of deaths that are either, they're not like, maybe not directly caused by corona, or like people wouldn't immediately think that they would be. And they are just being counted as regular deaths and not coronavirus deaths.
Yeah, I bet there's a lot of underreporting of like, oh, this guy died of pneumonia in May, because we don't have testing in Putney.
Yeah. Well, they're counting it. The main things they showed were like, even like New York, like big, they took like the six biggest epicenters, like the biggest cities.
Yeah.
They're having issues with it. And even in those cities, there's like I think Colorado had like a 300 person or 300 death difference.
Yeah.
To what was reported, to what was like a really big spike. And then like New York was like it's like 1500 or something like that, New York City. And then they did New York like state, and that was a whole other one, like everything but New York City.
Oh.
New Jersey was actually the worst one, I think. It's like probably just because it's, I don't know, right next to New York, but
yeah, probably.
But the difference in like what was reported and what was actual increased deaths was a lot. So, but that's kind of conjecture, because there's no way to know, more or less. But it was an interesting article. So everyone's dying. It's awful. It's terrible. Let's talk about something wholesome.
Yeah, like Logan, what are you drinking?
Oh, yeah, like drinks. Yeah, yeah. I was going to segue into the thing we watched. But let's talk about booze instead. That's also very wholesome and awesome.
Mm-hmm.
I am drinking a rum punch that I made. I basically have been getting really bored, and I have a lot of citrus. I've been trying not to waste my citrus peels, like the rind on my citrus. So I started making oleosaccharum, which is like a citrus peel oil syrup, basically. It's just sugar and citrus peels muddled together. And mix that with some acid-corrected pineapple juice and water, and made a punch mix out of it. And then I put in some plantation overproof rum. A little bit of dry curacao, a little bit of lime juice, because I wanted to balance that out a little bit. But it's pretty good. I'm enjoying it. I think I needed more spices. I don't have any spices at home. Not like the right kind of spices.
Yeah,
I added some ginger, and what did I add? I had ginger and a bit of like salt, to give it some like salinity. And that was kind of nice, but not nearly. I need more stuff, honestly.
You need like,
honestly,
like
some cinnamon.
Yeah,
cinnamon would be really good.
I was gonna say clove.
Clove would be
clove
pretty good
and
too.
Anise, like yeah. Clove and star anise.
Yeah, I don't usually like anise that much, but
really like
I mean, I think as like a sub flavor in this, it would be really good, honestly.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I'm doing that and just plantation overproof rum, and there's a lot of booze in this, but it's also really fucking tasty. I think we were talking about this before recording, but I think I really need to add more water to it in general, just because I think as it, like, even after I shake it, it's still not enough added water.
Really? Oh, okay.
So it needs more. Yeah, well, it just mellows out. Like, it's really citrusy and it's really sweet. And that's kind of what you want in a punch,
yeah.
I guess, but I don't really like that, so I think it just needs just more water, probably.
Does it
and
need
also, there's
more
just not
rum?
A lot of other. No, I tried that. I tried that first, and I was like, "Man, this just tastes like overproof rum. This is just booze. This is just booze." So then I like, you know, I added some dry curacao and some lime juice and some water, and it ended up being a lot better. Now it's like all the ice that I shook it with is melted,
okay.
And it's actually really good. Yeah, what are you drinking, Adam?
I'm also drinking a rum thing. I'm drinking a daiquiri that I made with a split base of Ray and Nephew and Plantation 3-Star. And the citrus is also acid-corrected pineapple juice.
Nice. Yeah, we did this like forever ago for like a bachelor party, but I finally decided to bust it out. I bought like just an obscene amount of pineapple juice on Amazon.
You did buy like a very large case of pineapple juice.
Yeah, I bought 24 8-ounce cans, I think. And they're 8-ounce or 6 ounces. I don't know. They're small cans.
The tiny ones?
Yeah. But it was like $21. It was like $21 for like 24 of them. And then it was like $10 for like 12 or something like that. And I was like, you know,
might as well.
I'm just going to buy a bunch. Yeah, I'm going to drink it eventually. It's not going to go bad. It's canned.
It's canned. You're buying in bulk.
It's going to last forever. And I've got like a whole giant thing of like citric acid to acid correct all of it. So I'm just going to use that as most of my citrus. And then, you know, I'll have other citrus juices just when I feel like it. But it's, you know, I put it in this this rum punch and it's pretty good. And I've been making daiquiris with it. I tried an egg white sour with it earlier. That was kind of interesting.
Oh,
so I was thinking like with pineapple juice, it already kind of foams up by itself.
Yeah.
So like it foamed up a lot.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
It was extra foamy with the egg white. But I think my eggs are starting to go because they kind of smell kind of funky.
I think
it's like bad.
Smell funky. Does it smell like wet dog?
Well, yeah, a little bit. So there's a couple of like YouTube bartender things I watch. And one of them, he was doing like he did a video about the difference between like dry shaking first or second, reverse shake to normal, like dry shake.
Oh, yeah.
Just to test them out. And he did it like on stream. And I was watching that. And he was talking about differences in that, and then he was like answering questions. And one of the questions was like, "Yeah, I feel like I always get like a weird smell from my egg." And his response was, "Well, if that's the case, you're probably using eggs that are a little that aren't like bad, but are like probably past their prime, because it's not a thing that he ever noticed."
Huh.
Like with fresh eggs that he uses, I don't know if maybe he just doesn't smell it. Like, because I've noticed it with almost every egg I've ever used.
Oh, I noticed it with every egg I ever used. Like, there's always that wet dog smell.
Yeah, just like slight. I usually just like put a little bit of Angostura on top, and that usually balances it out. Or if you get like, you like really extra express something on top,
yes,
that helps out a little bit
too. I found that expressing lemon on top, I think, really muddles it. Or putting just a fuck ton of nutmeg on top.
Oh yeah, nutmeg would be a good one too.
Yeah.
Ooh, so I was kind of thinking about
that in the punch.
Yeah, I don't have any nutmeg either. Nutmeg would be good though. I think I still have like, I made like a literal liter of this punch. So I have like almost a full fifth of it. I put it in an old Evan Williams Utterproof bottle that I have
awesome.
Just laying around. So I have so much punch. So I'll probably just like eventually go buy spices and just add it to
just,
it. Later.
Yeah, just drop them in the bottle. Let them steep.
I'll put it in the bottle and then I'll probably like also just add water to it. And then I won't have to add water to it every time I make something out of it.
I will
caution I was hoping
you about adding cinnamon. Because I've been making my own Amaro at my house because I have nothing else to do. And so I added like anise and juniper and clove. And I was adding it in stages to see what I liked and what else I wanted to add. and I added one thing of like a broken stick of cinnamon for like less than half a week. And no matter what I do to it, it's just cinnamon vodka just now. Cinnamon.
Yeah, cinnamon is a really overpowering flavor. Crazy overpowering. That's just a thing. Just gotta be really careful with it. But yeah.
So yeah, I didn't fail. I didn't fail to make Amaro. I learned how to make cinnamon liqueur.
Well, there you go. That's something at least. All right, Adam. So what are we talking about this week?
Oh, well, this week you chose what we're gonna talk about.
I did, yeah. Well, I think I gave you a couple options, and then we decided on this one. We're talking about Howl's Moving Castle, which is a Hayao Miyazaki film.
Yes.
By Studio Ghibli. And all those pronunciations are probably wrong, and I don't really actually care.
Yeah. So. Studio...
So I hear people say Ghibli or Ghibli. I don't know which one's
Studio Ghibli.
I'm just going to alternate.
It's sort of like GIF and GIF.
Yeah, actually, my favorite is Jife.
Jife?
Yeah.
You monster.
Just because fuck you.
You monster.
It doesn't make any sense no matter what you do, so just say whatever you want. It's fine. Don't worry about it.
You should just like go way overboard with it and pronounce it with as if it started with a J, but the Spanish pronunciation. So just say, oh yeah, Hife.
Hife, yeah, it's Hife.
A hif? Oh yeah, I'm going to send him a hif.
I'm going to send him a hiffy.
So yeah, we're talking about Howl's Moving Castle. What is your experience with this, Logan?
This is definitely not the first Miyazaki film that I watched. My first one was actually Princess Mononoke, which I would also like to talk about at some point, so I'll try not to talk about that too much. This is one of my favorite ones, most because I feel like it's a really nice balance between the kind of films that Miyazaki tends to make and more like traditional plotting for a lot of stuff. So the biggest thing about Miyazaki that I think it's important to know, like first off the bat, is that his plots to his movies, his films, always, they don't really fit like a traditional structure. Like, it's not like a hero saves or fights a villain to save the princess kind of thing. There's not usually like a guy or a person who goes to fight a thing physically or like combatively, and that's what saves the day. It's always like, friendship or compassion or, it more conceptual themes like that than it is like a direct kind of idea.
You're saying he just just pretty much never does the hero's journey?
Almost never. Well, he'll do it, but he always does it in a different kind of way.
Or he always fucks around with it somehow.
Yeah, because I Princess Mononoke, I think I could talk more about on that specifically, but then there's other ones that are like basically just like slice of life. I think Kiki's Delivery Service is the biggest example. I don't know if you've seen that or not.
I have not seen that either.
I like Kiki's Delivery Service. It's not my favorite Miyazaki film. I think it gets a little too slice of lifey, and that's not really what I'm into in general. Like a bit more conflict going on, because Kiki's Delivery Service has like, I don't know if we'll actually talk about it, because I don't, if we find someone else who really likes it, we can talk about it.
Speaking of that, my partner really likes it. They just made a drink called the Kiki's Delivery Service that they entered into an online cocktail competition today.
Perfect. Then we can absolutely, let's bring her on and she can talk about it, because I've seen it, I like it, but it's not something that I'm like super passionate about. Well, I was like, this movie I do really, really enjoy. And I think it's, how many Miyazaki, have you seen any other Miyazaki films?
I have seen Ponyo.
You seen Ponyo? Okay.
Yes.
So Ponyo is another one of the examples. It's kind of like slice of lifey. But that one does have like an overarching plot that kind of is a bit more like conflict based. Yeah. If that makes sense.
I also heard that Ponyo is supposedly based on The Little Mermaid. But it's very loosely based. And this, Howl's Moving Castle, is supposedly based on a book, but is very loosely based on it.
Loosely based. Yeah. Anytime Miyazaki is like basing it off of something else, he always tries to do like his own like full spin on it. He's not trying to just make the same thing or make it as identical to the source material as he can.
It sounds more like me when somebody like tells Miyazaki about a cool movie. They just give him like the gist, And then he goes, oh, that's neat. You know what would be cool is if...
Yeah.
And then he goes and makes that movie.
Yeah, that's
But I feel like he doesn't exactly actually, Miyazaki. Like, watch or consume the source material. Just, like, a buddy of his, like, when they're out drinking, he just likes... He's a movie maker, so he talks about movies, and someone talks about a movie to him, and gives him, like, the rough, like, rough draft rundown of the plot points, and he goes, oh, cool. You know what would be cooler? He goes and makes that.
Yeah, that's... I think it's honestly not... probably not wrong. I'm sure he goes a bit more in depth with it than that, but like, it's all of his movies do have this, I like feel that they are very they take their time with a lot of weird stuff that you wouldn't expect from most film. He likes to pause in the slow moments, and he likes to focus on the really like mundane aspects of people's life. Like this movie has a bunch of cleaning montages.
Yeah. Oh, I remember,
like, just because
there was one point,
but they feel really good though. It's like, it does that, and you wouldn't think that'd be interesting, but it's like an actual like character growth moment, and it feels good.
Like,
and he revels in stuff like that. They're like those small pleasures that you get in everyday life, and he just makes them interesting to watch.
I, you know what? Now that you said that, one of my favorite scenes from this movie, I think, is like Sophie's first cleaning montage, where she's an old lady. And like she wakes up the next day and she like has her sleeves rolled up and has her hair up in like a bun thing, and is just like sweeping with a broom like in the ceiling, and the room suddenly looks really clean behind her. I'm like, oh, cool.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's like, I don't know, it's a weird thing to feel, because I feel like a lot of, especially American films and American like stories in general are, well, I think it's worse in like film and TV, but they're very like by the numbers. It's like, this is our plot, this is what we're doing. And they are a lot of the time just going from beat to hit those plot beats.
Yeah.
Whereas Miyazaki films don't really feel like that ever. Like, after you've watched enough of them, you can kind of get an idea of, okay, well, it makes sense that this is what's going to happen next, because I've seen a lot of other Miyazaki films and I kind of know the direction he goes in things with things. But it's definitely not the typical structure of a lot of film.
So you're saying he has like his, I did notice that in this film. Okay. So one of the critiques I do have of this, and I think it might just be, I watched the dub again, because this is like a Japanese movie, but like, again, I'm dyslexic, so I just can't watch subs.
That's fair.
So I watched the dub, and again, this film really feels like it does not care to hold your hand and let you know what or why the plot is.
No, it sure doesn't. It sure doesn't and do that. I think that is kind of a Japanese thing in general.
Like
maybe there's some cultural aspects that we're not picking up on.
I think possibly. Yeah, I think that I feel like there's just like a lot of lost data, like when I'm absorbing this material. Either it's because like they don't translate the dialogue good enough to like get all the exposition that is in the original one, or that there's a lot of like cultural subtext and exposition that I'm missing. Because like, yeah, like if a Japanese person was watching a film and they saw like a main character like walk up to a sword that's stuck in a rock, and then he pulls out the sword and all of a sudden he is like glowing, they'd be like, "What? No one set up anything about this sword. Why is there?
Yeah, why is he glowing?
Why is he glowing? What's important?"
I think that's a little bit of it, and that's kind of a thing in Miyazaki films in general, is that he is very steeped in a lot of that like Japanese Asian culture and doesn't hold your hand to explain anything ever. Some anime goes the opposite direction on that, where it like over explains.
Yeah.
I will say Miyazaki films and Studio Ghibli films in general are like, they're almost not even anime. They're almost like their own separate category. Like, that makes any sense. Like I just hold them like, they're like a subsect of anime. Like it's almost not even like I would put them in the same categories as other stuff. Like holding like Akira and this movie up together, they just feel so different to me that like, I like, yeah, they're both animated and yeah, they're both Japanese, but that's about all they have in common other than I mean, maybe not explaining things. Like, that's the other thing.
Yeah.
I think part of, for Howl's Moon Castle, like, specifically, I think Miyazaki did read the book, and he just didn't focus on the stuff about the original plot that he didn't care about.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's a big part of it.
Yeah, well, I think...
Because you have, like, he's definitely, there's a war plot, like, plot line in this, but that's not really what's important to him. Like, that's a fact about the world, and it's a set piece, but he doesn't really care about fighting in the war specifically, or what the war is about, really. Like,
yeah, there's just, like,
you kinda, the
general concept of war happening is just what's going on, and we really don't get to know who's on what side, and...
No. Well, yeah. I think part of the point on that is that's not really what's supposed to be important. I was reading a little bit on this, and a lot of this, his ideas for this movie and how he is portraying war have a lot to do with his feelings about the Iraq War in 2000s, and his disillusionment with that. So I think that has a lot to do with it. So it's almost kind of like, that's the point, is that it's supposed to feel like the war doesn't really have a point, or that the main characters aren't really on either side, because they kind of, their general point is that either they're so outside of what's going on with the war they don't care, or they're just kind of opposed to war in general.
Yeah, like, I did like the fact there's several scenes where Hal is, like, flying around, or they see... Oh, yeah, there's one scene when they're in a garden, and they see a warship off in the distance, and Sophie goes, is that one of ours or one of the enemies? And they always refer to it as just the enemy. And she's like, is that one of ours or one of theirs? And Hal goes, does it matter? And then they see another one that's clearly a different color. And he's like, yeah, see? They're both the same. Doesn't matter whose they are. They're not ours, and we're not them.
Yeah. I think that's kind of part of the point of this movie, is that, like, the war is definitely, like, it's a point of conflict. Like, it's causing conflict in the characters' lives, but it's not actually the real point of the movie.
Yeah.
That makes any sense. The real point is, like, you know, showing compassion and finding true love and, like, that kind of deal, which I think is interesting. So what did you think of the dub in general?
I liked it in general. Like, yeah, like, yeah. The only thing I will say is that I was watching it with my partner, and they've seen it a lot, and they're a big Studio Ghibli fan. And so I was asking them some questions, like, throughout it, to know if I, like, oh, did I miss something? I was like, oh, why is she young when Hal looks at her when she's asleep? And, oh, why does she turn young there for a second? And my partner was, and like, do we get to learn that later in the movie? And my partner was just like, no, it's more no, just
they don't
like...
They don't really explain it. It's more of like, I kind of... It's a weird thing on the first watching, because I almost didn't even notice it the first time until, like, really late into the movie. But knowing it later, it's kind of interesting, because it feels pretty good to me, actually, because it's like she is, her feelings of love for Hal or her feelings of compassion, like, are shining through the curse almost. It's like almost breaking it.
Yeah. I was trying to figure out, like, there are several instances where she becomes, like, she goes back and forth between old and young, and I was trying to figure out what was the theme in those scenes.
The catalyst. I think in general, it's like self-confidence. It's like, it's not just, like, love, it's also just, like, her being, because it, and it's kind of a theme, because, like, the beginning, she's, like, kind of just mousy and not very sure of herself and kind of just kind of reclusive. And what brings her out of the curse isn't necessarily, like, finding, like, being in love with Hal. It's, like, finding confidence in herself and what she believes, despite, like, the things that are holding her back, is what I feel like what it is. I don't know. It doesn't really say, and I kind of almost like that, because I am also... So I think we had this discussion when we talked about Akira, too, in that I prefer anime when it doesn't explain things overly. Because that's the problem. Either there's two ends of that, where, like, either anime super over explains or it super under explains. And I would much rather it super under explain and let me kind of figure out my own conclusions about it, rather than tell me exactly what the fuck they're talking about all the time. And then I'm just like, well, it's like explaining a joke almost, like,
yeah,
because you over explained it, you kind of just ruined what you're going for. You know, if you just like, you give me a little bit of it's, you know, it's like the show don't tell kind of thing. You know what I mean? Like, we were talking about Community before the recording, but there was an episode in season 4 of Community. I noticed this really bad. But it's like they were describing how they feel about a thing or talking about why they didn't like being in the place that they are. And it's like, why wouldn't you just show me that? Rather than
tell me. Why would you have a character go like,
yeah,
I'm angry, rather than just go like, yeah, and just like show the emotion of anger.
You could totally have a scene in this, in Howl's Moving Castle, where Sophie's like realizes like, oh, well, when I'm more self-confident, I turn young again. That's interesting. And like, no, it's not. That's not interesting.
That's not interesting when you say it. Yeah, you know what? When you put it that way. That's, yeah, that makes a really good point. Just before this, like a couple weeks ago, I watched a mid-2000s rom-com called Penelope, where Christina Ricci plays a girl who's cursed to look like a pig, but really it's just like a very small, cute pig nose on the face of Christina Ricci. And so she still looks...
Who's still very attractive. She has like weird ears too, right?
Sure. I mean, it's more...
But she can hide those.
Yeah, she looks like an elf from Lord of the Rings, which, you know, that's hot.
Yeah.
And also she's Christina Ricci. And so like, and then at the end of the movie, she can only lift the curse by having one of her own kind love her. And then by the end of the movie, she's just like, hey, I like how I look. Like I have friends. I have a job. I have a boyfriend. Like I like how I look. And just her saying that like suddenly makes the pig nose go away. Because it's like, oh, no, you didn't have to have someone love you. You had to love yourself. And so I definitely sort of, that is someone. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you had to have somebody like you for who you are instead of who you are, quote unquote, like the rich girl who's supposed to be pretty. Like you had to just have someone like you for who you are, regardless of whether or not you have a pig nose, which is, you know, again, pretty easy because she's Christina Ricci. There's actually a point in that movie where like her face gets revealed to the press and everyone loves her and is really all about it, and no one's freaked out by it because everyone's just like, what do you mean? She really isn't that ugly. Yeah, the pig nose is kind of weird, but she also is like a really pretty nice girl because she's Christina Ricci.
I mean, yeah, it's kind of hard to take away the fact that she's Christina Ricci.
So yeah, I definitely looked at
who's the love interest in that?
It's somebody kind of famous. It's the guy who plays Professor X.
Man, I always forget his fucking name.
Yeah,
every single time. I really like him as an actor. He's really good.
Yeah, he is.
He's a really, really solid actor.
Oh yeah, and Peter Dinklage is also in that movie.
Oh, I didn't know that.
That movie is like early 2000s, and it sort of has like a lot of big hitters.
There's
James McAvoy.
You'll get those.
That's it.
James McAvoy, yeah. I really like James. Have you seen Split?
Mm-mm.
Oh, you should watch Split. Split's really, really, like, yeah, I don't know if it's like a pretty good movie, like, by itself, but, like, it's worth watching just to see James McAvoy just, like, act circles around himself. It's awesome. It's so good. Yeah, no, it's really good.
Okay, so, all right, well, back to Howl's Moving Castle.
Let's talk about Howl's Moving Castle.
Did not realize this movie was so recent. Well, I mean, 2004 is not super recent, but I thought this was like
16 years ago.
I thought this was from like the 90s.
Really?
Yeah. When I thought, like, when I first saw it, like, the castle, is sort of like half computer animated and stuff. And I figured I was watching like the 2010 remaster where they made everything look pretty.
That's where it's been. Yeah.
No, but okay. Yeah. It is.
Yeah, this is what it was like when it was released in the early 2000s, which actually, is really, really good. Like, having seen a lot of like computer remaster, like computer, like animated stuff next to regular animation. This is one of the times I think it actually works really well.
Yeah.
Because there's other stuff I've seen that looks bad,
like
really bad.
Howl's Castle specifically, you definitely like when you first see it and it's like moving all around, it stands out because it really looks like it's animated differently, but it looks like it's storybook animated. Which gives it,
I think,
a really good, like, magic-y kind of, oh, this is otherworldly. Like, they knew that they couldn't make it look exactly like it was animated, so they decided to make it look like specifically different, like a different art style, exactly. But still really good.
And I think that's the times that I've seen like that CG thrown into regular animation where it looks really good like that is exactly in this kind of circumstance where it's like you're dealing with something that is so out of the norm for everything else that you've been looking at that it makes sense, that it like draws attention to it in a good way rather than in a bad way.
Yeah, it hangs a lampshade on the fact that it doesn't look like everything else.
Exactly. Studio Ghibli, I think there's a couple other times they've done this in newer movies. And I think this is probably the best example, and this is probably one of the best examples of it being done in anime in general. Is there's a couple of anime that I like a really like a lot, like Full Metal Alchemist Brotherhood. I don't know if you've seen that or not.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so I really, really like that version. Like, I like that one better than I like the original, like Full Metal Alchemist.
I think everybody does.
Everyone does, and they're right. Except for the fact that the only thing that really bothers me is Envy is CG.
Yeah.
And it looks bad.
It looks weird.
It's bad. It's just bad. And, like, I don't want it to be bad, because I really, like, I see what they were trying. They were trying to do the same kind of thing with it as they were doing in Howl's Moving Castle, where it's like, oh, we're going to make this really big creature that has all these weird heads and shit coming off of it. So, like, of course, yeah, let's make that CG, and it'll make it even weirder. And it just didn't land.
Doesn't work.
But this is an example of, like, when that worked really well. That same idea fits perfectly in this.
You know,
and there's
for the title being Howl's Moving Castle, the plot really doesn't revolve around the castle or Howl very much.
Yeah, it kind of doesn't. Well, Sophie is the main character, I think, even in the book.
Yeah.
And I think I like her better as being the main character. Like, if the main character was Howl, this movie wouldn't be as interesting.
It wouldn't be a Miyazaki movie.
For sure it wouldn't be a Miyazaki film. And that's probably why Miyazaki gravitated towards the original story, is exactly because of that.
Yeah.
So I think that has a lot to do with it. So I don't know if you noticed this or not, or if Kat told you. The voice actor for Howl.
It was Christian Bale.
It's Christian Bale. And I didn't even know that the first like couple of times I watched this. And then I actually looked it up. And I mean, obviously the other big star in this one is Billy Crystal is Calcifer, which is really weird, which is obvious. And honestly, like, doesn't bother me that much. Like, there's some people that it really takes them out of it and they don't like it at all.
I actually really liked it.
I think it fits. This is one of the times, like, Studio Ghibli's English dubs have, like, a really long history of they pick famous people, but not necessarily the right people to voice act certain characters for their English dubs, because they're trying to, like, market it, like, towards American audiences more.
Yeah.
So, and what sells to American audiences more than, like, a really good performance is usually a really big name. So, instead of picking the right voice actor, I think usually they just pick, you know, the biggest name they can get for said role.
Like, if they had picked,
biggest person,
like,
they can get to play in it.
If they had picked, like, Eddie Murray or Eddie Murphy to, like, be Calcifer.
Yeah, that would have been really bad.
That would not have been good.
Yeah, they've also, I don't know if they were at this time, but now they are being, like, localized by Disney, basically.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah.
So, yeah. So you'll know, I think Ponyo has one of the Jonas Brothers in it. Yeah, he plays the kid. But yeah, so Christian Bale is the biggest one for me. And honestly, I think this one, it really worked for me, except for there is one scene where he is, he's like turning into the bird monster thing.
Yeah.
And he's speaking in a really gruff voice. And it's just
the Batman voice. I did not catch that.
It is just the Batman voice. I was like watching it. I'm like,
that's okay. Batman.
That's just Batman.
But you know what? Like, I mean, having Batman voice, Birdman, is actually pretty prescient. Cause
yeah. Well, I think this is about the same time Batman Begins came out, right?
Oh, is it? I thought this is definitely. It came out before Batman.
I probably did. I mean, he probably did the recording before that. Let me find out really quick. Batman Begins.
Okay.
I would almost
answer me a question about how
2005.
Yeah, so this is like pretty close to when he was working on his voice for Batman.
Yes, I bet he was doing like early filming or early practice. Yeah, this came out 2005. Well, so it came out, let's see here, the original Japanese came out in 2004. So that means the, say, release date.
Yeah, it premiered at the Venice Film Festival in September of 2004. So that means that it must have, like, they must have done the act, like, the voice acting, like, in, like, 2003.
Yeah, probably yeah. so.
But if Batman came out in, like,
well, yeah, but you gotta think they do the Japanese before they do the English.
Oh, yeah.
So I bet the English adaptation.
Oh, probably came later.
Voice acting.
Oh, yeah, so yeah. Although, like, he would have been, yeah, he probably had, he was working on that voice, at least.
Almost definitely. This is, it would have been, like, right at the same time. Let's see here.
Yeah. Okay, so what's with the magic? What's going on magic. Here? Who's the lady in the wheelchair? Why is Hal turning into a bird? Is it bad that he's a bird?
Yes.
Okay.
On the second one. The first one, it doesn't really explain at all. Solomon is just... It's Hal's old teacher. She's kind of a dick.
Seems like kind of a dick. And also, like, when Hal uses his magic, he gets kind of bird-like, and then...
Yeah, it's kind of steeped a little bit, and it's part of the plot towards the end. It has something to do with the deal he made with Calcifer to gain more power.
Yeah.
And that's the whole deal, is that if he uses more of it, I'm assuming it makes his condition worse,
Yeah,
they don't really explain it very well. But that's basically the idea, is that because he gave his heart up to Calcifer for power, which empowered both of them. It allows Calcifer to become a more powerful demon, and also makes Hal more powerful magician.
Yeah,
and they talk about it a few times, like, oh, Hal gave his soul to a demon, and
yeah,
Calcifer is the demon.
I kept imagining, like, oh, we're gonna meet this demon, or it's gonna be a lie. There was no demon, and. He gave his heart to a demon means, like, he broke up with his fiance or something. But it turns out, oh, no, it's Calcifer. Oh, that makes sense. Yeah.
It's Calcifer. Which, I mean, it does make sense. I think it's kind of like a bait and switch almost, because it's, you know, you've been interacting with this demon this entire time, and he just seems like a nice guy.
He seems like a nice guy.
And every time anyone else talks about how giving up his heart to a demon, it sounds like a really, really bad thing.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it is. Like, it's definitely causing him issues. But it's not that bad, really. Like, the demon he gave it to is kind of an okay guy. So
And, like, his teacher was like, he gave his heart to a demon, which means that he has no emotion. It is an asshole. And then Sophie's like, no, that's not what that means. He is a nice guy. He just, you're thinking heart and heart are two different things, lady.
Yeah. I think that's kind of a part of the whole idea of it. There are, like, weird plot points that, like, I still don't really get. So, like, there's Solomon's dog.
Yeah.
He's just, like, around.
He's just around and doesn't...
Doesn't do anything.
Like, I thought that was going to be, like, a Chekhov's gun for something significant. Like, the dog was going to turn into a dude and be like, oh, here, I'm here to help you or something.
No, it was the Scarecrow Man instead.
Yeah, it was I did like Mr. Turniphead.
Yeah, Mr. Armahead, he's like interesting to go through, but then, like, they tie that into, and it might have been in the original book plot, but then it feels very tacked on in this movie, where, like, it wasn't even necessary. That it turns out that's the prince from the kingdom, and that's the reason why the war's been fighting this entire time. And
yeah,
oh, it turns out he's in love with Sophie for some reason.
Yeah.
Even though they barely interacted together. So, you know, I feel like that's another one of those things where it was, like, it was probably elaborated more on in the original source material, and Miyazaki's like, it's fine, don't worry about it.
I think her and Turniphead have more screen time and dialogue than her and Hal, which I... Yeah, this movie may have really been better served by having a reason why Sophie and Hal fall in love. You know, if they had a conversation during the movie, it probably would have helped.
The biggest thing is... So I was thinking about this in my rewatch, because this is a thing I've noticed before, and I do kind of agree that they don't really have super great chemistry. Their relationship isn't really built that well.
No.
But there's, like, quiet moments that kind of make it work for me. So, like, they don't like really lean into. So, like, the first time they meet, Hal is basically saving her. He's rescuing her from, like, two dudes who are basically going to rape her.
Yeah, that was intense.
That's just a thing. Yeah, no, I was rewatching them, like, oh, shit. okay. So like that's kind of cool, and that's like another reason to show that like Hal's in general just a good dude.
Yeah.
It's like he doesn't know this chick. He doesn't know her at all. He just like sees a girl who is being like sexually assaulted by two soldiers and is like, no, fuck you guys. No, you don't get to do this.
Like, I'm also being chased, like, but I'll take some time to like save this girl.
Yeah, like he had no reason to do that at all. So I think that moment did it a little bit for me, and then like they had the little air walking scene. So that's like their initial like connection. And then her just being like a compassionate human in general, like yeah, she's like working for him and cleaning his place, but like the idea is that she's like caring for him in a way that no one else really has.
Yeah, yeah. He's getting upset about his hair sense. And she like gets him upstairs, gets him a bath, stuff.
Yeah, like that kind of stuff. So it's there's no like real dialogue that really convinces me, but it's like those like actions kind of give it to me a little bit. But yeah, I don't think it's as earned as the ending like makes it out to me.
No.
Yeah.
There could have been those quiet Miyazaki moments where like it goes through how feeding every single eggshell to Calcifer, which I did like, maybe, you know, maybe cut back on those by like 30 seconds each and give us like that's couple not Miyazaki, scenes though. Where they have an intimate conversation.
That's not Miyazaki though. I mean, honestly, like, so he's always very much about like the concept of love and compassion, but his like romance plots are never really that well developed. Most because I don't think he really cares as much. He's more about things that you can make visually interesting, and it's really hard to make those visually interesting, I think, in general. So like the times where he did manage to do that were like those action scenes, like action in quotation marks, like that people were doing things to show their love. Those worked, but he's not good at like developing like dialogue reasons for people to be in, you know, in love with each other. And I think that's not just a thing in Howl's Moving Castle. That's a thing I've noticed in like pretty much every Miyazaki film I've ever seen. So it's like even Ponyo, like, I mean, it's like childhood love, but like it doesn't make any fucking sense. It's like,
yeah, no, it doesn't.
Just a fish girl.
Fish girl. I like you. Why?
Her dad's killing everyone.
All right.
It doesn't make any sense. But yeah, and then there's a Princess Mononoke is another example. I think I like the way Princess Mononoke works a little better because it's not even, it's like this one, it makes the romance part of it like a really big plot point. Like it's a big reason for like the very ending part where Sophia is saving Hal's life and, you know, he's like succumbing to the darkness from his curse and she like saves him, and it's like an act of love. And that's all really tied in together. Whereas like in other Miyazaki films, like love is an aspect, but it doesn't work as well. One I think it actually does work really well in is My Neighbor Totoro, is more about like familial love.
Oh.
And I think Miyazaki does a really good job of capturing that. But like romantic love, not so much, which, you know, is kind of a bummer. But overall, I do like really, really enjoy this movie. Is there anything else? Like what else do you have to talk about this movie?
Ooh, okay. I really liked the depiction of her being old, because like the first night she like was panicking, and then she wakes up, and then she walks over to the mirror for the first time the next day and notices that she wasn't dreaming. She is old. And the first thing she says is, "Oh, this isn't so bad. You're still pretty spry. Got all your teeth. All right, let's set off on an adventure." Apropos of nothing,
I think the things that work for me best about this movie are, I mean, A, the visuals, because obviously it's Miyazaki and it's Studio Ghibli. It just looks beautiful the entire time. And then B is Sophie as a character is just like really well developed and just feels really good. Like,
yeah, like you're rooting for her the whole time.
Yeah, and like it's such a, it's so like pro, like it really shows like elderly people can still do things. Like it's definitely pushing that agenda. And then it's also because she is the hero, she's not Hal, she's not like blowing up ships or, you know, flying around doing cool shit or, you know, doing magic. She's just like a person.
Yeah.
And is just, you know, doing her best. And like, she just legitimately cares about people. Like, she's just a caring, nice person. And without her being in this plot, it, you know, would have ended terribly for everyone. And that's kind of the moral of the story is that, like, you know, she's like just her being a good person, just her doing what she can when she can to help other people saves the fucking day.
Yeah, she saves the Witch of the Waste who cursed her. Mm-hmm. She saves Hal. She saves Calcifer. She saves the rando prince which subsequently ends the war.
Yep. And she like, honestly, there's a lot of like emotional scenes in this movie. The only one that really gets to me, and it got to me even when I watched it this last time, was her and Markle. When like Markle, like it's like right after.
Oh yeah.
Right after Hal like basically takes Sophie back to her home, and Markle is like really afraid she's gonna leave, and like literally like, hugs her and is like crying like, oh, I don't want you to leave, like, you know, you've done so much good for us. Like, I love you, Sophie. And like, they've known each other for like 2 weeks, but she's left such an impact on this kid's life.
Yeah.
Whereas before he was kind of like, you know, Hal was like his teacher, but you know,
he didn't have like,
Hal's basically like a man child.
Yeah. He didn't have like a parental figure of any sort.
No. And this is like the first thing that he's gotten. You don't really get much in Markle's like background, but like just that, like that brief little interaction where like, you know, this kid, you know, it's gotten something from her, and just that outburst just, you know, it feels really good. And it doesn't even like, there's other movies and other things that I've seen do similar things where they're like, have a small kid, like say something really sweet like that, where it doesn't,
it just falls flat.
Doesn't fall flat at all, because like, and it's not even that they had like a bunch of dialogue together. It's just, you saw them interacting together. You saw them like doing things together.
Yeah.
And it works.
I think the love story between Sophie and Markle like works way better than the love story between Sophie and Hal.
Yeah. Yeah. I would agree with that, honestly. But you know, it is what it is. Like I said, I don't think the romance in this really like follows through that well. It's okay. It's serviceable. Yeah. I think both of the actors do it a good job. I think the actress who plays Sophie does a way better job than Christian Bale does.
Yeah.
Conveying. I mean, to be fair, she also has a lot more time to like, and a lot more dialogue to really work with.
Yeah, that's true.
So I think that helps it a lot. I didn't really know this. I mean, it makes sense thinking back on it. There's actually two actresses who play the older Sophie and the younger Sophie.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
That's a thing. Yeah. It's like an older actress who plays, and it's like a, someone who's kind of big. I don't recognize who it is, but she's like a star from like black and white film, which is crazy.
But yeah, that's hey, an old lady who is great to play an old lady.
Yeah, she did a great fucking job. Yeah. It's Jean Simmons, that's who it is, which is funny because it's not so not, it's not, not, Jean, it's not Simmons. Jean Simmons, not that Jean Simmons. But yeah, so I think it, yeah, I really like Sophie is probably the best aspect of this, honestly. She might be my favorite Studio Ghibli Miyazaki protagonist.
I can see that. I can't put my finger on it, but I really, really like Sophie. She's great.
She's just really likable, nice, and it's really refreshing that like, so you've got like this plot that's all about war and magic and curses and all this shit, and she's like fucking seamstress, you know, like she's not. Yeah, she's not anyone like special really, except for, you know, she's just a good fucking person.
Yeah, she's a great person. And like, her mom's a piece of shit. His mom's a shithead.
Yeah. I do kind of like, so even her mom is a shithead. They give her mom even like a little scene where like her mom knows that she did a bad thing and feels bad. Like, she has like one like little bit of dialogue.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, I like that, because it would have been really easy just to make her mom just a total asshole.
Yeah.
And that's just not how Miyazaki usually works. Like, he doesn't like, even, we should watch Princess Mononoke, because I keep wanting to talk about it. We should watch Princess. You haven't seen Princess Mononoke, right?
I have not.
Okay, we should definitely watch that.
Okay,
I think this. I still like picking this one better as like one of your first, or one of, if we're expanding on your Miyazaki and your Studio Ghibli.
Yeah,
this is one of the better films to start with. I think, because I think it just It's the least confusing. I think Princess Mononoke is the closest.
This is the least confusing Studio Ghibli movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty close.
All right, then.
I mean, you've already watched Ponyo, though, and Ponyo is like, I don't even know what's going on half the time.
Ponyo is very confusing.
It's very, very confusing. Very, very, very confusing. Princess Mononoke, I think, is closer to like a Western plot, if that makes any sense. Like, the theming is definitely still the same as like this, but the way the plot rolls out, I think, is a little closer. Although, we should watch that one. It's really good. Also, I think the English cast is actually pretty good. There's a couple that are kind of weird, but well, we can talk about this another time. But anyway, I think this is definitely a good one to start you out in, just because it's, I don't know, I feel like this one's the more balanced. It's one of the more balanced Miyazaki films, because then you've got it's kind of like an in between of some of his more action oriented stuff and his more slice of life kind of stuff, which I've seen more of the slice of life. I still haven't seen I forget what it's called, Nausicaa in the Valley of the Wind.
Oh, I've heard that.
I hear is really, yeah, I heard that one is really good, and I haven't seen it. I should probably do that at some point. It's one of the earlier ones.
Yeah, I would definitely down in the 80s, I think, to watch more of this, like Princess Mononoke, and then like, and then which is like I'm picking up the most actiony, mm-hmm. and then
yeah, I would and say then, so.
Like Kiki's Delivery Service,
at least of what I've seen,
I'm picking up is like the most just happy, just slice of lifey.
It's very slice of life. It's I think My Neighbor Totoro is pretty close to about the same. I think Kiki's is probably a bit more, though, because Kiki's like doesn't even have like a real plot.
It's just he wanted to make a cool movie about a delivery witch,
basically.
All right,
that's what it feels okay like. It's that. Just like, you know, she's a delivery witch.
Deal with
that's
it.
That's what's going on. There's no like, at least in this, like there's kind of like antagonists, like there's like
the war, and the war is like keeping Hal.
Yeah,
from
in this
just
one,
like,
it's basically just it's the war or Hal's curse, or you know, at times it's the Wicked Witch of the Waste. Or
also,
Solomon.
Can we talk about the Wicked Witch of the Waste?
Yeah,
like
for sure.
What a weird character!
It's such a weird fucking character. Like her skin is made out of goo, basically.
Yeah,
like it's weird. Even when she like looks young, she's still just like it, like it's like she just shaped herself into the shape that she wants to be, and she's just made of goo.
Yeah. And then also
her
like
skin,
I
don't know.
I do like the fact that Sophie like the witch like rolls up on Sophie, and Sophie mm-hmm. just can't help herself but be really nice to her. Like she tries to be mean to her so hard, but then by the time they're at like the top of the staircase, she's like, come on, you can do it. I can't help you. I'm old. And like at halfway up the staircase, she's like, I can't help you. I'm old because you made me old. And then she's like, no, I really can't help you. I'm old. And by the end, she's like, hey, I can't help you, but I'll cheer you on.
Yeah, it's that's like one of the moments I like a lot, is that like Sophie is like throwing shade at the Witch of the Waste like hardcore.
Yeah.
But at the same time, she's still like, she's like, no, come on, you can do it. Like, yeah, I'm being an asshole to you, but come on.
Yeah,
no, you're still a person.
Just, even when she's
like, you did a shitty thing
hardest,
to me, but I...
Even her worst enemy in the world, and she's trying her hardest to be an asshole to them, she just is, she's just such a good person.
Yeah, she's so nice. Like, you know, even people that are, like, just shitty towards her, she still just, like, wants the best for them overall, you know? Like, not that she's gonna forget that they did a shitty thing to her, but is also just like, you know, I don't want you to like die.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you know, I want you to like keep living your life. I just want you to just not be a shitty person.
And then she like takes it, and then she loses her power. So she's like, well, you're here now, so I'm going to have to take you home and tuck you into bed and stuff and make you soup. And she's like,
I know, it's so cute. It's so cute.
Like, all right, I guess.
I love it. And it's like the one character is like Solomon that Sophie just like is just like, you're just kind of a dick. Like, no wonder Hal doesn't want to come here, because you're just trying to take his powers.
Yeah,
like, why would he want to do that?
You're just an asshole. Fuck you.
You're just like a warmongering mage. Like, what the fuck? Like, what's wrong with you? And that never really has, like, a... Even, like... But it's the thing. So this is the thing in a lot of Studio Ghibli films, is that usually the antagonist isn't a person, and he does a really good job at... the people you think are like in a lot of like less complex movies, you would just have like one person who's just kind of a dick,
yeah,
or just an asshole in general. and they're the antagonist, and they're just a bad person. And that's the gist of their arc, that they're just a bad person. And then eventually the hero will beat them. I can't really think of specific villain of any of the ones I've seen where that ends up being the case in a Miyazaki
film. I guess
it's always, they're always just people. Like they might be doing something shitty or something that overall is hurting other people, but typically their motivations aren't, oh, I just want to hurt people, or they're not like sociopaths. They're still just people that are trying to, you know, further their own goals, and usually they're just happening to also fuck someone else over. Typically,
it seems like a lot of movies and just like a lot of like simple media have characters that are physical representations of bad things, like representations of war, or representation of like man's callousness, and like the hero can just overcome those conceptual things by punching this one guy. But Miyazaki seems to like, no, the antagonist is war, and we're going to show that by there being war and no
There's
motivation
literal
for
war here. Yeah. I will say, I'll draw a comparison between this and Akira, and I think Akira actually does a pretty good job at this too, where Akira, the only like human character, like that's not there for more than a few seconds, that like is kind of not a good person, is like the scientist.
Yeah.
And like he was kind of a bad person, but he was more like just like his own like audacity or his own like hubris was the actual thing that killed him, not that he was like a terrible person himself. But even like the general who's in there, who like stages a coup on the government, and like
that guy
at the end of the day, he's like, he's trying to prevent like a fucking nuclear bomb from going off, basically.
Yeah, pretty much.
Like in an American like movie, the general would have been the good guy, because like, yeah, he did some shitty things, but like overall he's got these psychic kids he's trying to take care of, and he's trying to stop a fucking bomb from going off. Like, you know, that's what he's trying to do. That's... like, you know, yeah, he's gonna try to shoot a teenager, but like also the teenager's gonna blow
but
up
the,
and
the
kill,
teenager's
like,
a nuclear
all
bomb
Tokyo.
So what are you
yeah,
gonna
so,
do?
Yeah, so like, you know, what do you want from me? It's like, you know, it's, and maybe that's like, I don't know, like those, that's just a connection I can draw from those two pretty easily. Yeah. I don't know if that's like a more common theme from certain Japanese artists or what, but it's a very common theme in Miyazaki films. I can tell you that for sure.
Well, I'm very glad that for a while I thought I was just like missing a whole lot by having not read the book. Like, I feel like I was missing a lot in Akira by having not read the books. Mm-hmm. But it seems like Miyazaki just doesn't tell you everything, because he's like, no, it's more important for me to show you how feeding calls for all these eggshells than for me to explain most of the magic that he does.
Yes.
And I'm like, you know what?
Yes.
All right, that is a choice. Don't know if I agree with it every time that Miyazaki makes that choice. But it is, yes, he has specifically chosen to do that.
There is definitely a balance there, but you can definitely tell that, like, that's actively a choice that he decides to make all the time, where he's just like, you know, I don't really care about explaining, like, I'm not interested in explaining this to you.
No.
That's
we
not,
need to get at
that's
least
not interesting.
8 to 10 seconds of Billy Crystal going, hum, 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 hum.
He's, but that's the thing though, is that he's so much more interested in like visual aspects of stuff and like weird, quirky stuff like that.
He's like, let's see if we can animate somebody cracking an egg with one hand really good.
Exactly. Which is, I
how
just
hungry
can't
we make
out.
People I, when we show them this bacon and eggs? I bet
it
a lot.
It looks really good. I really wanted bacon and eggs after I saw
dude,
that.
Dude, right? I really wanted bacon
it
and
looked,
eggs after that.
It looked really tasty.
Okay.
And you're a you're vegetarian.
I know, but I'm not vegetarian because bacon tastes bad.
Bacon tastes really
bacon
good.
Bacon does taste very good. Bacon tastes so good that I like veggie bacon.
I feel that.
Which is objectively not good.
that's fucking fair.
All right, okay, so all speaking of tasting good, how can we make a drink out of this?
Do you have any like final comments or topics you want to talk about on this movie before we go into that? Because I think after we go to that, it's going to be that's all it for House Moon
Castle. I don't know. I don't think there's any like final thoughts I can have about this movie, because like
it doesn't have that much of a plot.
it really does
not have that much of a plot. Like, you could, like, if you were going to describe the plot of this movie, like, a nice lady meets a wizard. She gets cursed by a witch. She goes and cleans up that wizard's house. She befriends the witch and the wizard, but again, she just figures out that she can break the curse by being a confident, nice person. And then that's it.
And then they end the war.
And then they end the war. And then someone would go, wait, what war? And then you go, yep.
Yep.
But you
that's pretty much
right. Yeah, like the last sentence of that plot summary should be, and then they end the war. And someone should go, wait, you didn't mention a war before. And you're like, well, the movie didn't either.
Fucking basically. So I think the better question is, how did you feel about this movie in general?
I enjoyed it. Yeah, I definitely, I enjoyed it. I'm not going to say like, oh, I love this, it was so great. Because as somebody who writes and is kind of a writer, I definitely do enjoy having a plot to my movies. Mm-hmm. But this was still fun. I really liked listening to Billy Crystal be a fire demon.
Me too. Yeah. Me too.
Billy Crystal, like, Sophie, I think that's favorite character. Second favorite character, Billy Crystal, the fire demon.
Calcifer is pretty great.
I really like Calcifer.
Yeah, I will say. And it's so weird because I feel like that could have gone really badly. Like, Billy Crystal in this could have been just, like, way off.
Really jarring and take you out of the moment.
It just really wasn't.
But no, it just felt pretty good. He was just like, hey, lady, you gotta, he puts the right amount of emotion into it all. Like, when he's all worried about, like, he's about to go out. And he's like, Sophie, I'm about to go out. Sophie, what are you doing? You gotta help me here, Sophie. I'm gonna fall off the lock. And it's just so... It works so
every
well.
Every time it was... All those, like, pathetic Calcifer moments are actually some of my favorites.
Yes, those are the best ones.
It feels so good. Yeah, no, I think... overall, like, obviously, I recommended this movie. I like this movie a lot. It's not my favorite Miyazaki film, but I think it is definitely one of the best ones. It's like top two for me for sure. And I agree that in general, and it's like a common theme in a lot of Miyazaki films. Like, I like a pretty solid plot. Like, I like all the other stuff it does in this movie a lot too. So I can't really be mad that they like push the plot aside for those.
Yeah. Like, if that makes any sense. Really like, when like Hal fed Calcifer one eggshell, I was like, I hope he feeds them the rest of them. And then the shot just stayed there and he fed Calcifer all those eggshells. And I was like, this is satisfying.
Yeah, it's the thing though, is that it's refreshing, I think, is the thing. There's a lot of this movie that's so wholesome and nice, and the main character is just such a sweet person, and like
the amount of plot,
it's a very feel good movie, even though like some of the themes it's dealing with are kind of heavy.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really focus on those. It's focusing on like life's pretty good. If you're a nice person, just be good to people.
I feel like it works really well because the amount of plot we get feels like the amount of like plot information that Sophie would have gotten.
Yeah.
And the perspective of Sophie.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And like, if Hal was the main character, I think you would have to focus more on like the war and
like how that started Solomon and why it's going and what he's
and how magic works.
Specifically what he's doing when he's like fighting against the war.
Yeah. Because there's like a whole, they don't really explain the movie, but he's like fighting on both sides.
Basically. Yeah, he's just going to his house of both ships.
He just keeps going back and forth because he's trying to like deter the war rather than end it, basically.
Okay.
So I in general, I like this movie a lot. I think the thing that is nice about it is that it's just a wholesome movie.
It really is.
It just feels good. It just feels good.
Okay, so how would we make a drink about this? We got to make a wholesome drink.
That's a good
drink.
Fucking question. Okay, well, I mean, we should probably name it after Howl's Moon Castle, just like the castle itself, I think, or maybe Calcifer. I think those are the two,
Calcifer,
the two big Sophie. Things.
Or bird magic.
Or Sophie. Or bird magic. What about something to do with the heart dealio between Calcifer and Howl? That could be a thing. Or Yeah,
I think it was House Moving Cocktail.
Yeah, that's good. That's actually pretty good. House Moving Cocktail.
All right, if we wanted to make a wholesome cocktail, how could we do
that? Yeah, it has to be wholesome. I mean, it's going to have an egg white in it.
Does it? Okay.
I think so.
What base spirit could we center this around?
I feel like a cognac or like a brandy. I don't know why. That feels like the first idea that popped in my head. It just feels like that kind of movie.
I was going to go with like gin because it's very English feeling. Mm.
Yeah, you're right. Actually, that's a fair point. I was thinking kind of like old timey. So I think gin works too. Maybe gin. I feel like something to capture like the magical aspects of this could be interesting.
Yeah. I feel like, okay, should we just make exactly an aviation, like old Tom gin?
That's not a bad idea.
And then like the flowers like has creme de violette.
Oh yeah, Sophie's a florist.
Well, she's a hat maker. But...
Oh yeah,
but then well, yeah, but then a... like then later she gets a flower shop.
Yeah, maybe she has a little bit of both. I don't know.
Yeah,
she just put flowers in hats. Maybe she just already had like practice. In
the... She definitely starts off as making things at a hat shop.
Yeah. So yeah, I think. But I think florist is her more. That's her like dream.
What's a drink that would make you not want to go to war?
Gonna have to be boozy. Probably.
Or maybe like Old Tom Gin, sherry.
Ooh. Okay. Doesn't sound bad. We still need that floral aspect. I mean, I'm a pretty big fan of orange flower water.
Orange flower water?
So I have the Fee Brothers orange flower water is really, really
good.
I do
have a bottle of that. It is very good. What about, or like lavender bitters?
Nice. Lavender could be nice too.
Okay, so there's a traditional flip with like a whole egg in it is made with like 2 ounces of sherry and then like 1 ounce of simple syrup or something like that. And then like a whole egg.
Hmm. That sounds weird.
Yeah. I've never that's had like one, a that's a that sherry flip. Weird. But we could make like 1 ounce of Old Tom Gin, 1 ounce of a very raisiny like cream sherry, and then something to sweeten it back up a little bit.
I mean, you could try like we have a lavender syrup we use at Fidel's. It's pretty good actually.
A lavender syrup? How do you make that?
Monin. Well, we don't make it. Monin makes a lavender syrup.
Well, you could get like
it's pretty decent.
My partner has this lavender Earl Grey tea.
Oh yeah,
because Earl Grey. Yeah, you can make a lavender Earl Grey syrup.
I like that actually a lot. Yeah, a lavender Earl Grey syrup with the Old Tom and sherry, whole egg.
And then crack a whole egg into that
something.
Make it a flip?
Yeah, yeah. It's like I need something. I need something else.
Hmm. Like what?
What do you think about like a couple dashes of Peychaud's or maybe absinthe?
I don't know. Well,
an absinthe rinse.
I feel like that would make it like too austere. But like what about like 5 drops of orange flower water or like a dash of orange flower water?
I can see like that.
Lavender, Earl Grey, syrup, like really orange flower water, sherry, and Old Tom Gin with a whole egg.
That does sound... Man, that sounds really floral. I actually kind of like that.
Sounds really floral. It sounds like really good. Sounds like really good and happy and wholesome. And like...
Yeah. Yeah, I'm into it. I'm into that a lot, actually.
Yeah, I am too.
Howl's Moving Cocktail.
Howl's Moving Cocktail. Yeah, I...
You gotta double shake that shit.
Yeah, I think I like that. No, yeah, you definitely have to double shake it.
Yeah, you gotta get that. You gotta get that egg. Like, I've never had a flip, so like, you keep the yolk in it.
Yeah, yeah, like the whole, like a whole egg.
Man, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's good.
I believe that.
Okay, well, like, yeah, I guess that's it. That was Howl's Moving Castle.
There you go. Did you already write it out?
No, I haven't. I have not written out the thingy.
What kind of glass do you serve that in?
Oh, what would you serve it in? Would you serve it up?
I don't know. I like serving things up. I feel like that might be too fancy for this movie, though.
I feel if we serve it down, then like it might be. No, like we can serve it over like a big rock.
Mm-hmm. Like one big rock seems pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah, like one big rock in like a rocks glass.
I'm pretty.
Yeah, so you can water it down. Yeah. I like that. Okay, so yeah, that's Howl's Moving Cocktail. Alright, good, I like it.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's pretty
good. So yeah, alright, well that was Howl's Moving Castle. Good catching up with you, Logan. Tune in next week where our topic is gonna be Doggone, also known as Diamond Dog Caper. It's a 2008 American comedy film directed by Mark Stuffer and starring Luke Benward, French Stewart. Also French Stewart.
Oh yay, French Stewart. Yeah. What's he been up to lately?
Well, I can tell you what he was up to roughly 12 years ago.
Oh man. All right. Well, it's good. It's good talking to you.
All right. See you, Logan.
Later, Adam.
I'm Adam.
And I'm Logan.
You can find me on Instagram at Adam1Z4J2.
And you can find me at Redenfield, RedenField.
And if you just want to get in touch with us like directly just for the podcast, you can go ahead and email us at overlyhornybostonbusdriver@gmail.com. Logan, how do you spell that?
Okay, I'm not spelling that, but it is... Overly horny Boston bus driver, all one word, no spaces, no caps, @gmail.com. Pretty easy to figure out.
Looking forward to your emails, everybody.
Sure are.